This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. It is, in part, a story of striving and a story of struggle against prejudice. It is also, in part, a story of political scandal, violence, and racial bigotry. Ultimately, though, it is a success story. This afternoon, we're going to look at the experience of America's Irish. Our guest is historian Jay Dolan, author of The Irish Americans, A History. The book opens with the first arrivals of Irish in America in the 18th century, a piece of the story not well known. Through the arrival of millions beginning in the mid-19th century, the result of the Great Famine, through the rise of Irish political power and the election of John Kennedy as president, up to the present, when, Professor Dolan notes, it's chic to be Irish. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call. In the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free line, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Jay Dolan is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Notre Dame. His scholarly interests include immigration and ethnic history. His previous books include The American Catholic Experience, A History from Colonial Times to the Present. His new book, The Irish Americans, A History, is published by the Bloomsbury Press. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Professor Jay Dolan, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
How has what it means to be an Irish American changed over the course of our history, U.S. history?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, that's a 300-year history, so obviously there's been significant changes in an Irish person's self-identity. I guess to simplify it, I would say that coming to America as an immigrant and being in very real sense an outsider in the American community in the 19th century, I think the Irish felt as Catholics, as foreigners, that they were definitely on the margins of society. But I think as time progressed, certainly by the end of the century, the early 20th century, the Irish Paddy had become the American Patriot, and they were celebrated and screened, and Al Smith got the nomination for the presidency in Democratic Party in 1928. Of course, he lost, but the Irish were arriving, and I think certainly have become part of the mainstream of America. I think that's fair to say by the first half of the 20th century. And then with the election of John F. Kennedy, I think the Irish symbolically had made it, and now an Irish person could be, you know, a young Irish man could become president of the United States. Mm-hmm. So I think they've gone from the margins as outsiders, discriminated against, to becoming now insiders in the mainstream.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. At the outset of your book, we have the Irish. Being Irish was bad enough, you write. Being Catholic only intensified the discrimination. And now, the last chapter of the book, it's chic to be Irish.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, being Catholic, I mean, I think it's well to remember that back in the 19th century, the first half of the 19th century for sure, the United States was primarily a Protestant country, and Catholics were looked upon, you know, like the Moonies in a sense, the outsiders, strange religion, loyalty to the Pope, you know, and even in 1928, when a little ditty they sang, a vote for Smith is a vote for rum, a vote for America's scum. I mean, they were, you know, the Ku Klux Klan took them on along with the Jews and the blacks. And so, you know, they had this history of discrimination, and they were definitely discriminated against because of their religion. And but I think it's fair to say that that is pretty much passed into history.
Are there parallels between the Irish-American experience and that of other immigrant groups? And did the Irish-Americans in any way help us move toward a more inclusive society?
I think so. And I think definitely in terms of religion. I mean, so many Irish came here, then Italians and Polish and Germans and so on. the Catholics became one of the single largest religious denomination in the country. And America now had to, you know, could no longer be defined as a Protestant country, so it had to become more inclusive and accepting Catholics as part of that American identity. So I think it helped the nation to accept, you know, to become religiously pluralist and accepting of Catholics and Jews as well as Protestants. And I think that was, you know, the size of the Catholic population forced the rest of the American population to accept them as part of the American society.
Mm. Well, Irish and Catholic go together like a horse and carriage.
Right.
But it is fascinating to know that most of the first Irish immigrants were Protestant. They were Presbyterian Irish.
Yes. That's one of the, you know, for me, one of my own self-discoveries. A former student of mine, Patrick Griffin, who now teaches at Notre Dame, has written on the 18th century and, you know, educated me, I think it's fair to say, about the Irish in the 18th century, that most of the Irish who came to this country, about three-quarters of them, were Irish Protestants from Ulster. And by 1790, the Irish in this country, 1790 was the first U.S. census, and by 1790, about 10% or 400,000 people of the American population were of Irish descent. Most of them were Protestant. So to talk about the Irish-American experience as a Catholic experience is not completely accurate. It includes both Catholics and Protestants up until the, I would say, the 1830s or 40s, and that's when Catholics began to outnumber Protestants, and as these ragged immigrant newcomers landed on the shores of New York and Boston and so on, the Irish Protestants didn't want to be identified with them, and so they coined the term Scotch-Irish, in a sense, or adopted the term Scotch-Irish, to set them apart from Irish Catholics. And so ever since then, it's been an Irish Catholic story, whereas in the 18th century, it was really a Protestant Catholic story.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit more about this breaking apart between Irish Catholic and Irish Presbyterian, because both groups were very proud of being Irish, and they had a commitment to Irish independence.
Oh, yes. Many of the leaders of the Irish independence movement were Protestant. Charles Parnell and others of his type. But I think the major transition, the major change took place in the early 19th century when the number of Irish Catholic immigrants outnumbered the Protestant Irish immigrants. And they became the dominant force in the Irish community. And so the Protestant Irish did not want to be identified with them. And I think it was also a time when religious sectarianism was roaring and raising its ugly head, you might say, and Protestants and Catholics were at odds with one another. This was a time of a lot of anti-Catholic rioting in Philadelphia and also New York. And so... The split between Catholic and Protestant intensified in this period, and that alienated Catholic and Protestant Irish from one another. And then with the large numbers of Catholic Irish coming, the Protestant Irish just didn't want to be identified with them. And so they set apart and they founded their own organizations, their own fraternal societies, and just went their own way in a sense.
Mm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Jay Dolan, author most recently of The Irish Americans, A History. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments about the history of the Irish in America. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, that's 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello?
Hi.
Yes. I had a question to what extent has the Americanization of the Catholic Church used as a template for the post 9/11 respect to Muslim Americans? And could you comment on the ethnic tension with the Irish Americans historically, with other minority groups like the Tories with the on the building the Transcontinental Railroad, or the New York draft riots, or for that matter, the Chicago race riots in 1919.
Okay, that's a lot of history.
Yes. Well, I think the Irish related to other ethnic groups. I think it's fair to say that the Irish, like most ethnic groups, were very clannish. And there was an intermarriage was when an Irish man married an Italian woman. I mean, it was very unusual for a Catholic Irish person to marry a Protestant American. It was very unusual as well for an Irish person to marry a member of a different ethnic group. This obviously changed in the 20th century, and intermarriage became more common among different ethnic groups. But I think one of the real antagonistic relationships was between Irish and the African Americans. It goes back into the 19th century, the 1863 draft riots in New York, and this relationship between Irish and African Americans was, something that persisted right down into the 20th century, into the 1960s, and the race riots on the south side of Chicago, for example, Irish neighborhoods. So that's been a relationship that's been very tense over the years and a long history. And I think it's fair to say that I think it's better now than it was 40 years ago.
Does a listener want to follow up?
Well, I probably compounded my question too much. I was just wondering about the Muslim Americans and attempt to all the talking about Abrahamic religions, whether it seems giving equal rights to Protestants, Catholics, and Jews seems to be extended, but I wonder if that has any relationship to, you could say, the Americanization of the American Catholic Church, whether that's being used as sort of a template for the Muslim religion.
Okay. Kind of a mainstreaming effect, you think? Something like, is that what you're trying to get at, caller?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that, the Catholic Church and American Catholicism has become more and more mainstream than I think you might say that the 1960 election of John F. Kennedy was a symbolic moment that Americans, certainly by a razor thin margin, were willing to accept a Catholic as president. And so the religious test, if you wish, in terms of Catholics had been eliminated. In 1928, they were not willing to accept the Catholic as president, but by 1960 they were. And I think, the Catholic Church in this country has become very much Americanized, although you'd have to acknowledge that a large percent of the American Catholic population today is Latino, and many of them are immigrants or second-generation immigrants.
Well, I was just wondering that during the last present presidential election, there was, there was incorrect attributing to Obama that he was a Muslim, and there was one of the kind of anti-Catholic. I was going back to even the anti-Catholic things, and even Kennedy's. President Kennedy's, whether he had to overcome that, whether there was a similar type of thing, whether that's within the mainstream or not.
Well, I think it's fair to say that Kennedy's election signaled the arrival of the Catholics, in the sense that henceforth a young Catholic person could aspire to be president. And I think Obama's election signaled the arrival, in the sense of African Americans, so the young African American boy or woman could aspire to be president of the United States. I mean, he kind of broke through the barrier.
And even in a so more so because that 1960 election was so close, a lot closer than our election of 2008.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's take another call. I want to thank our listener in Champaign. Let's take another call. We'll go next to a listener in Palos Heights, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello. Thanks very much. I wanted to ask about the place of Irish Catholics in the 19th century in the Catholic Church in America, and wondered if as Irish Catholics first came in the 1830s and 1840s, as you suggest, did they first come as parishioners and then it would take some time before there were Irish priests or even Irish Catholic bishops and archbishops? How long would that transition take?
Good question. When the Irish came here in the early 19th century, I'm talking about, you know, the 1830s and 40s, they came with a folk religion. Institutional Catholicism was not strong among them. I wrote a book called The Immigrant Church back in 1975, and I followed it up with another book called Catholic Revivalism in 1977. And in those two books, I talk a great deal about this early period of Catholicism among the Irish. And they really were not Mass and Sacraments type Catholics. They rarely went to confession, occasionally went to church. But I think it's fair to say that they were evangelized by the clergy and eventually became what we would call traditional Mass and Sacraments type of Catholics. And there's no question that the Irish ruled the Catholic Church in this country. I mean, by 1900, two out of three bishops in the United States were of Irish descent. And if you go to Chicago, I think it's like two-thirds of the parishes in Chicago in the 19th century, the late 19th century, are Irish parishes. One of the interesting things, of course, is that the clergy followed the Irish over here. In fact, bishops went over and recruited. And I talk about this in the book, where there were seminaries in Ireland, as well as convents in Ireland, that sent priests and nuns over here. Specifically, seminaries were founded to send priests to the missions, and most popular mission was the United States. And one of the pictures in the book actually is a picture of a group of young women sailing to Philadelphia who had been recruited by the sisters in Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri, the sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet. So the clergy followed the Irish, and that helped to strengthen the church as well and strengthen the faith of the people. I think it's fair to say that first generation, the 1830s and 40s, they were, you know, not traditional Catholics. They were what I would call folk Catholics, and they became more Mass and Sacrament, traditional-type Catholics later on.
And may I finally ask, is that largely an urban Irish Catholic development? If I recall correctly, Irish immigrants would work in rural and urban areas in the 19th century, and so does the development of Catholic Irish as clergy, and even more so as archbishops and bishops, is that primarily an urban phenomenon first?
I think you'd have to say that. I mean, there are Irish in the rural areas, but, you know, the Irish population was the most urban population among the European immigrants except for the Jews, and they were heavily settled in the cities of our nation. Some, of course, went to the rural areas, the mining towns and so on. But overwhelmingly, they were an urban people, and that's where the church was overwhelmingly an urban institution. That's one of the issues we're dealing with today. All these churches in the cities where the Catholic population has disappeared, and we have all these empty, vacant churches.
Okay. I want to thank the listener in Palos Heights for his call this afternoon. Our guest this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine, Jay Dolan. He is a historian. His latest book, The Irish Americans, A History. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. Join our discussion, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call now. A listener on line two in Urbana.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm an Irish Catholic that immigrated in 1954 with my family, and I was wondering if you could speak to the issue of how families would bring other members out and work together for economic benefits, send money back home. Some even reverse immigrated back to Ireland. Is that something you can just address?
Yes. One of the phenomena of immigration history is chain migration, where one member of the family, oftentimes the father and maybe the eldest son, will come over first, set up a situation, maybe renting an apartment and so on. And then once they were established and could afford to, then they sent for the other children, and finally the mother, the wife of the family. And so it's kind of a chain migration phenomenon where bit by bit, piece by piece, an entire family would immigrate. Annie Moore, who was a famous young Irish girl who was the first person to pass through Ellis Island in 1892, was part of that chain migration. Her parents had already immigrated here, and they sent for Annie and her younger brother, and they sailed from Cork and landed in New York at Ellis Island when it first opened in 1892. So that's a phenomenon that was quite common, in the, not just with the Irish, but with other immigrant groups as well.
You want to follow up?
We were one of the last ones through Ellis Island from Cork in May of 1952.
Yes, you were.
Yeah, history goes round. Thank you so much.
Annie Moore, as you know, came from Cork. And there's a beautiful statue of her in Cove, the seaport there outside the city of Cork where the ship sailed from, an immigration museum there as well.
Well, thank the listener for her call. That must have been quite an experience for a young girl, and so many young girls. Let's go next to a listener on line one. Good afternoon. Where are you calling from?
Champaign.
Okay.
I'm only half Sheik, half Irish. So on my mother's side, it was 100% Irish. And when you talked about, you know, in terms of her childhood, it was pretty difficult for her because of, besides even being Catholic, I mean, Irish, we were in a community that was, mostly Protestant, and the burning of the crosses and some of these things. But eventually, I think the big breakthrough is when all the churches started, you know, having, talking about other people's dinner, that other people's churches. Before that, it was a little bit different. One of the questions I have is that I've been to Ireland. It's a marvelous place. You feel at home within 10 minutes. I mean, where did the Irish wit come from? I assume part of it was because of a lot of the tragedies and a lot of the toughness, or what? Would you know that?
I would be guessing at that one. You know, I think the Irish are great storytellers. They love to tell stories. The Seanchéi is a great Irish tradition of the storyteller. And I just think, I don't know. I mean, that's just a trait of the Irish personality. They love to talk. They love to write. And I think that they have a certain fluency in the language. And I guess they love to tell jokes.
Yeah, but it's sort of an unexpected wit. They tell a story about Churchill where he was in, was it Milo, or is that a town? But there were two clocks, and what happens, one was 5 minutes fast, the other was 5 minutes slow, and being accurate, he looks at his watch, and he said, one's fast, one's slow, and the retort was that that's why we have two clocks. You know, in Ireland, a lot of the buildings have four clocks, but none of the time. I mean, it always amazes me in terms of the wit. You know, where does this come from, I mean, the unexpected, really. So, wonderful program.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You want to follow up, Professor Dolan, on that at all?
Well, there's a great joke about the Irish and the Spanish, and an Irish priest talking to a Spanish priest, and the Spanish priest... The Irish priest asked the Spanish priest, what are the people like in Spain? He said, oh, everything is mañana, mañana, mañana. And the Spanish priest said, what are the Irish like? And he says, well, in Ireland, it says, people don't have that sense of urgency. I think, what you can't put off today, you put off tomorrow. I think things have changed dramatically, though, since the Celtic Tiger in the last 20 years or so. They become more and more like the rest of us, and I think a lot of the charm of Ireland is evaporating.
Well, my family was forever late. God. And it led my mother to set the clock in the kitchen 10 minutes fast. And, of course, we all knew what she was up to, and we called it kitchen standard time. So, yeah. So anyway, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Jay Dolan, author of The Irish Americans, A History. Well, I want to go back to the first wave of Irish arriving in the 18th century. Irish Presbyterians and Irish Catholics They came because of religious intolerance at the hands of the English government, and they also came motivated by economics. Yet most of these first wave Irish were Presbyterians. Why? What were there impediments to Catholic emigration?
That's a good question. I think the Presbyterians came for the same reason that, you know, most immigrants came, for bread and freedom. They were being unfairly taxed, they felt, by the Anglican Church in Ireland. They were Presbyterians. They were outsiders. They were marginalized, just like the Catholics were. They had penal laws against Catholics and penal laws against Presbyterians, penalizing them because of their religion. And so they came to this country, and I think, you know, Catholics... Kirby Miller, who's a historian at the University of Missouri, has written a great deal on Irish, and he feels that, you know, at this time, the Irish in the 18th century just, you know, didn't have that concept of immigration as part of their self-identity. They, whereas the Ulster Presbyterians and the Ulster Catholics were being forced out for economic reasons and religious reasons, the Catholics were more in the South and the East, Southeast and West, just didn't have that sense of immigration as part of their destiny. It was only until the famine in the 19th century, and of course the development of the transatlantic immigrant trade, that enabled them and persuaded them to leave Ireland.
Yeah. So, these first immigrants of the 18th century, the Irish, did they speak English or Gaelic or both?
Good question. I think it's, again, we don't know a lot about this, but I think it's fair to say a lot of the letters that I've read were in English, but we know Gaelic was widely spoken among the Irish people well into the 19th century. I would say, you know, well, they say during the famine about 500,000 Gaelic speakers came to this country or immigrated. So the Gaelic language, the Irish language, was widely spoken, but many of them were also English speakers as well. And again, the letters that I've read, of course, and the letters that are most available for the 18th century were in English.
Mm. Let's take another call. A listener in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Another great program. My question's about during the Civil War, there were draft riots in New York and when they were trying to draft Irish immigrants. I just wondered, obviously, young Irishmen wouldn't be anxious to come over here to get involved in the Civil War, and the state-by-state, especially back then, it was the states that mustered up their armies to fight in the Civil War, and I just wondered if you could... talk a little bit about the difference between, say, New York and Ohio or Illinois or Indiana or something like that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yes, well, the Irish were very involved in the Civil War, both on the south on the side of the Confederacy and the side of the Union. And I remember traveling to Gettysburg and National Park there, if you wish, and... seeing many monuments with the shamrock on them. The Irish were, you know, large numbers of Irish fought in the Civil War on both sides of the divide, so to speak. And one of the most famous regiments was the Fighting 69th out of New York City. And they were gathered together by Thomas Maher, who was a famous Irish immigrant and later Civil War general. And they fought in some very bloody battles at Antietam and Gettysburg and but they were not any more representative than any other immigrant group at the time. They were nobody likes to go to war and fight, but it was a very bloody situation, obviously, and the Irish were part of it.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line 1. Hello? Line 1?
Hello. Yes.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm enjoying your show, but unfortunately still today there is a lot of bigotry and racism against Irish, especially here in this town with the unofficial St. Patrick's Day bar crawls sponsored by the bar owner, Scott Cochran. And this year it took 3 days of drinking in the name of St. Patrick and being Irish. And I would encourage all people of good faith and goodwill listening to this program to contact the members of the city councils of both Champaign and Urbana and the mayors of Champaign and Urbana, Schweigart and Prussing, and demand that this unofficial St. Patrick's Day bar crawl by Cochran be stopped immediately, that we do not see it again, and it be put out of business. Indeed, I would also recommend you demand that Scott Cochran's liquor license be revoked. He's completely incompetent. I've also found in my own dealings with the city councils and the two mayors that pretty much everyone here in town is making large amounts of money out of the bar and liquor industry. They're all in cahoots together. So you also need to contact the Illinois Liquor Control Commission up in Chicago and demand that they terminate this unofficial St. Patrick's Day bar crawl activity here in Champaign-Urbana, and that they revoke the liquor license of Scott Cochran. I think if we can accomplish this together, we can all have a safe, healthy, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
Okay. Any comment there?
Well, no. I think the gentleman has a point, and I think that you know, sometimes, obviously, people overdo it on a lot of occasions, especially St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, I, for the life of me, I don't understand what green beer has to do with St. Patrick, but...
Or coloring the Chicago River.
Yeah, well, for that matter, right. Well, let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Hi. In a way, it's completely tangential, but earlier you did bring up the... matter of the Scots-Irish. And it's my understanding the two populations are actually the same, that the Scots migrated from Ireland, when was it, the 2nd century B.C.? And the two languages, Scots Gaelic and Irish Gaelic, are indistinguishable to the day. Hello?
Yes, yeah. The Scots settled Ireland in the 17th century.
No, no. If you look at ancient history, the first migration of the Celts into Britain...
the Celtic, yeah.
Well, yes, was to Ireland, across Britain into Ireland, and later they were driven out by the second migration into Ireland, but that they had migrated back into Scotland, so that Scots Celtic is the same, indistinguishable from Irish Celtic.
Right, part of the Celtic culture, if you wish, the Celtic language and so on. You have that in Wales. And
well, no. The Welsh are the second migration, and their language is closer, much closer to the Breton.
Right. And what is your point now?
My point is that there's no difference between the Scots-Irish and the Irish, that they're the same population.
Well, culturally, they sure are different. I mean,
right.
Well, because of the introduction of the Presbyterian Church.
Yeah. Okay, let's let the guest respond.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I guess what I'm saying is that the Irish who came here were Irish. Irish in the 18th century was an inclusive term, including both Protestant Irish and Catholic Irish. But over time, Irish became a sectarian term, if you wish, distinguishing Protestants and Catholics. And Scotch-Irish became a nomenclature, if you wish, to describe Irish Protestants vis-a-vis Catholic Irish. I'm not sure if that's what you're driving at, but, I mean, they are part of the, you know, they're all Irish, but they see themselves differently. They identify themselves differently, and the difference really is the religion rather than the ethnic cultural background.
I want to thank the caller for his thoughts this afternoon. And before we run down on time, we've got to talk about politics. going back to the first wave of Irish arriving before the Revolutionary War, were they involved in politics, Catholics and Presbyterians?
In the 18th century?
Yes.
Yeah, not so much. As to the best of my knowledge, no. I mean, Catholics in Maryland couldn't vote. Even though Charles Carroll of Annapolis was one of the richest men in the colonies at that time, in the 1750s, Catholics were denied the right to vote. And they were kind of, in a sense, ostracized from the political arena. Socially, they were prominent, socially, but politically, they were not powerful at all. And that was the situation in Maryland, also in Pennsylvania. And so because of their religion, because they were Irish Catholics, they're more or less disenfranchised. So they weren't politically that active.
Yeah.
But they do become very politically active, obviously, in the mid-19th century.
Yeah. And part of that involvement started to grow out of becoming volunteer firefighters?
Well, they, you know, these volunteer fire companies were kind of the breeding ground for a lot of local politicians. I think it's fair to say they were fraternal organizations. Young men joined them, and they became the base for their political activity. And if they could deliver their fellow members, deliver the votes of their fellow members on election day, then they got some notoriety, some power in the party. And so these clubs were kind of the breeding ground for politicians, not just Irish, but other groups as well.
Yeah. When I read that, I was reminded of Tip O'Neill, who said all politics are local.
Right, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about a political player. Here, as we're confronted with the allegations against our governor, maybe we could look back to a pal by the name of James Michael Curley. Tell us about him.
He was a cross between a crook and a clown, they said. I mean, Curley was, again, a man who pulled himself up by his own bootstraps. He was the mayor of the city of Boston four times, served in the U.S. Congress twice, was elected to office while he was in jail twice, was a one-man political machine in Boston from the early 20th century up until 1940. So he was a very colorful character. One of the great stories I like about Curley was he walked into City Hall one day and he saw the woman on their knees mopping the floor, wiping up the floor there. And his mother was a washerwoman who worked in the offices downtown at night. And he was horrified to see these women on their knees scrubbing the floor of the City Hall. And he said to them, "The only time you get on your knees is when you go to pray to your Lord." And the next day he ordered mops and gave mops to all the women in City Hall who were cleaning the floors so they wouldn't have to get on their knees anymore. But he was that type of fellow. They'd line up outside his office and, wanting to get favors from him, and he doled out favors, you know, for a couple hours a day.
Mm. And you tell a story early in the part of the book that deals with Curley, and that is he had his campaign workers go and knock on doors.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us that story.
Well, his opponent, he was running for Congress, his opponent at the time, I can't think of the man's name at the moment, but
let me see if I can.
Thomas Joyce was his name, yes. And
okay.
So he was running for the House of Representatives. And so that night, the night before the election, Curley sent out his workers to knock on the doors of the Joyce supporters, late at night, around midnight. And so the people were already in bed, and they have to go up and answer the door. And they got there, and they asked them, "You know, what are you doing here?" And they say, "Well, we're campaigning for Thomas Joyce. We want you to vote for Thomas Joyce." And they looked at him and they said, "You know, I wouldn't vote for that son of a gun if his opponent was an orangeman." And that was kind of one of Curly's dirty tricks, to kind of do unto others before they do unto you.
Well, the Associated Press, now I'm going to break in here. The Associated Press on this December 17th, 2008, is reporting from Springfield, Illinois, that the Illinois Supreme Court has refused to hear a motion to declare Governor Rod Blagojevich unfit to serve. Let's take one more call here before we run out of time. And this is a listener, I believe, in Urbana. Line one, yes, go ahead.
Hi. My grandmother was English, came in through Quebec, born in Quebec. Her husband was, my mother said, used the term Scotch-Irish, and I wondered what you knew about folks that had ended up in America but came in through Canada.
There was a goodly number of folks who came to America, came to the United States through Canada. In fact, in Boston, there's a saying that they came from the ice, which meant that they landed in Quebec, one of the harbors up there along the St. Lawrence, and walked down through Canada, Maine, into Massachusetts, and they were often referred to as those who came from the ice, kind of the more poor Irish who couldn't afford a ticket from Liverpool to Boston, but could get a cheaper ticket to Canada. And, of course, there's a sizable Irish population in Canada, but it was very orange color, very Irish Protestant. The Orange Society was very prominent in Canada among the Irish.
Does a listener want to have a follow-up?
No, I just wondered if he would make those comments.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. We're here coming down to the last minute or two that we have the time to spend together today, Professor Dolan. I was wondering if there's anything that you would like to wrap up with that we haven't touched on that you think would be a way to wrap up or something that we haven't touched on that is really important.
Well, I think, as I try and explain in the book, that, you know, this is a success story. And I think that's one of the great things about this country. It's, the Irish weren't, of course, the only group that you could say was a success story, but certainly they emerged as one of the best educated, one of the most prosperous ethnic groups in the country by the 1960s. And I think that this country provided these poor immigrants who arrived with hardly shoes on their feet and the clothes on their back and nothing else, and their ancestors were able to make it. I mean, I always go back to John F. Kennedy and his great-grandfather, Patrick Kennedy, who came over during the famine in the 1830s and as a young man and died of cholera within 8 years, and his wife raised the family, and her son, Patrick Kennedy, became a saloon keeper and a major politician in Boston, and her grandson became Joseph P. Kennedy, and her great-grandson became the President of the United States. I mean, that's, granted, that's an unusual saga, but it, in some sense, you know, symbolizes the Irish story, that they came with nothing, and over generations, over time, they made it and became one of the best educated, most prosperous groups in the country.
Yeah. And now it's so exciting to see Ireland doing so well.
Yes, I mean, it's when I was there in the 80s, it was a third world country. Today it's a major player in the European economy and the common market, and it's doing quite well.
There we'll stop. Jay Dolan, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Jay Dolan is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Notre Dame. His scholarly interests include immigration and ethnic history. His latest book, The Irish Americans, A History, is published by the Bloomsbury Press.